Okay, good afternoon. I returned on Wednesday night after a successful six-day trip to Russia and Japan. In Russia, I attended the APEC Economic Leaders meeting and met bilaterally with a number of my counterparts, including the Russian President Vladimir Putin. We discussed the FTA negotiations between New Zealand, the Russian, Belarus and Kazakhstan Customs Union. I made it clear that New Zealand is fully committed to concluding this FTA negotiation and achieving a high-quality agreement. President Putin confirmed Russia also wanted to conclude the FTA. He acknowledged that there were domestic concerns among some Russian farmers, but thought the negotiations were moving in the right direction. He's confident the deal can be done, and he formally invited me to Russia next year, an invitation I hope to accept. There was no formal meeting of the TPP leaders this year. However, the negotiations have strong momentum, and a number of leaders I spoke to said that they would like to see TPP concluded sooner rather than later. I also spent several days in Japan to commemorate 60 years of diplomatic relations between our two countries. I was accompanied on this leg on the trip by 11 Japanese language students from Christchurch. It's been a moving day in the Tohoku region, where I addressed a memorial service to the victims of the Great East Japan earthquake. This was an opportunity for me to acknowledge on Japanese soil the 28 Japanese students who lost their lives in the Christchurch earthquake. I also thank the Japanese Urban Search and Rescue Team for their swift response during Christchurch's time of need last year. Japan and New Zealand's shared tragedies have given our two countries a special connection. During my bilateral meeting on Tuesday with Prime Minister Noda, we agreed we wanted to continue working closely together as our countries move ahead with reconstruction and put in place policies and infrastructure designed to limit losses in future earthquakes and tsunamis. You would have seen Paula Bennett's announcement today about changes to the benefit system. Today, the government's social security benefit categories and work focus amendment bill was introduced. This is the latest in a series of steps we have taken to redesign the country's welfare system. This stage of legislation, which we campaigned on at the election, includes simplifying the current seven main types of benefit into three. These are job seeker support, sole parent support, and supported living living alone. Alongside those, three main benefits are the two smaller groups of youth payment and young parent payment. The new job seeker support will have a 12-month reapplication process, just like the unemployment benefit does currently today. Establishing new benefit categories signals a fundamental change to the benefit system. By increasing its work focus, it will help to ensure the services people receive are based on their circumstances and not their benefit type, and make the benefit system easier to understand. Underpinning these changes is our belief that by targeting the right support to the right people at the right time, we can enable people to move off welfare and into work sooner. We believe those who can work should work. At the same time, support is still there for New Zealanders who are in need. These changes to the benefit system will come into effect in July next year. The Finance Minister, Bill English, announced today the schedule for the Hui to consult with relevant Maori on the Shares Plus concept raised on the Waitangi Tribunal's interim report. Six Hui will be held in the next 10 days with iwi and hapu that have a specific connection to the freshwater and geothermal resources used by the state-owned power companies Mighty River Power, Meridian and Genesis. Over the next 10 days, he will listen carefully to the iwi, talk through the issues with them and explain the government's view. We are also inviting the iwi to write to us by Friday, October the 5th. In the House this week, the government will be looking to progress a number of first readings, including the Environment Canterbury Temporary Commissioner's Improved Water Management Amendment Bill, the Social Security Benefit Categories and Work Focus Amendment Bill, and the Student Loan Scheme Amendment Bill number 2. Wednesday is Members' Day, and Thursday morning the Business Committee has agreed to extend the hours to progress the first and second readings of four treaty settlement bills. In terms of ministerial activity, I'm in Wellington on Tuesday and Wednesday, the Chatham Islands on Thursday and Friday. I've got a number of functions in Auckland on Saturday and Sunday.
Prime Minister, the Labour Party says if it was in the government, it might apply an economic test and block the sale of fishery in the Pikeville. should you do the same?
Look, I hadn't seen any advice on that matter. I mean, this is now subject for the Overseas Investment Office to look at merits of the bill or the merits of the application from hire. I would prefer to comment when we see their advice to the relevant ministers.
Is it disappointing, though, that a company like that, with innovation and R&D, could be gone from New Zealand and gone from the share market?
Well, in terms of being gone from the share market, that has some impact on the market capitalisation of the NZX, and that's a little disappointing. On the other side of the coin, they, I think, have made some quite strong commitments to being a New Zealand-based company with a New Zealand head office. I mean, Fisher & Paykel have a very proud history. The government actually stepped in and tried to support that company in 2009, but it was in real trouble after the global financial crisis and the impact of some of the hedging of their exchange rate. So, look, I think we would obviously hope that the company would continue to remain active and operative in New Zealand. Whether there's any, what the outcome of the bid by hire to buy the balance of the shares they don't own is a matter initially for the Overseas Investment Office and then government.
Do you have any capacity to, in your ministerial role, to block it if you decide that it wasn't in our economic interest?
I'd have to go and have a look exactly at the law. I mean, they have to comply with the law, and then I guess it's like land, they make a recommendation to ministers, and there'll be some capacity that's probably fairly narrowly defined in law in terms of their capacity to say no.
Yep, just fine. The other concern about this is that there might be more companies that are picked off. There's a lot of Asian money, of course, looking for somewhere to go. More New Zealand companies which we can't afford to lose may end up in offshore hands?
Well, at one level, I mean, investment in New Zealand companies means that we're actually producing companies and products that the world wants. Secondly, it's also true that there is a lot of cash out there in some of these fast-developing Asian nations, and they are looking to tap into the expertise in New Zealand. On the other side of the coin, KiwiSaver and its investment profile does give opportunities for New Zealanders through the KiwiSaver accounts to invest. And of course, if we're in a position, which we hope to be next year, to bring the mixed ownership model companies into the onto the market, into the capital markets, then that will provide more depth for that New Zealand capital markets.
Following the King's, Ryder King's call the other day that Māori own the water, Peter Sharp was set this up and he had a discussion about the term ownership because it means something different in Māori than it does traditionally a party owner. Do you think there needs to be a discussion or debate about ownership, or are you really in that about what it means?
Well, in terms of ownership, I can only talk to you about the Pākehā terminology of ownership and what that means, and the government's position is crystal clear. No one owns water. That's been our view. It's the long-held common law view, and of course there will be Māori who want to express what they believe are their rights and interests. In some cases the government will acknowledge and recognise those rights, but I suspect when it comes to some iwi, we won't believe there's a validity to the claims they're making.
The Ngāru Kāwhiti of the Māori Council says that the consultation process that you've set up is too narrow because you're only focusing on select iwi with those interests in that certain amount of ritual. What's your response?
Well, she is trying to confuse two different streams of work. One is around recognising rights and interests, and the other is around the mixed ownership model, with the sale of shares and Mighty River Power and the other two SOEs in any way limits the capacity for the Crown to recognise rights and interests. When it comes to the latter point, we are absolutely clear in terms of the legal advice we've received that the right approach is the one that we're adopting. That's why we've made that decision. In terms of the first one, the government also had a framework for working through that. We've been doing that for 4 years, looking at rights and interests.
Just on top of your warmest comments about culturally ignorant.
Yeah.
What's your response to him?
Well, obviously I don't agree with that. At the end of the day, there's a view held by some, clearly the Māori King, who Tiffany Morgan these days works for, that Māori own the water. I think that's totally wrong.
Why bother having a hui on Shares Plus when actually the government's already pretty much
about. Well, the government's made it clear that it's taken legal and financial advice about the merits or otherwise of Shares Plus. As a result of that advice, we don't think there's any merit in the scheme the way it was at least very loosely prescribed by the Waitangi Tribunal, although the Tribunal itself said it hadn't fleshed out fully the idea. But on balance looking at it, we don't see any merit in that. What we are doing, though, is saying, well, look, if we've missed something, here's the opportunity for those affected iwi to put up a case about why weakness sets. So good faith will listen to their arguments. If they come up with some arguments we haven't considered, or the similar same arguments we've had presented to us, obviously we'll go and give them our perspective on
it. So are you leaving that door slightly ajar for you to change your mind on shares plus if the government can be convinced?
If there was an argument that we hadn't heard and that had merit, of course we'd listen to that. But we've certainly sought the best legal and financial advice we can. At this stage, we don't see any merit in it.
I think you've found it unacceptable, the shares plus. You use the word unacceptable a bit too.
That's our view.
So it's your view that's unacceptable?
Correct.
So what's the point of talking about it? Sorry.
Because there could always be, we go through a consultation process, because there always could be an argument put up that we haven't thought of. Now, we've tried to fully explore that, but in good faith, we'll go and listen to any argument that might be presented.
You intend to leave the door open to legislation today, but the Māori has already given a cast iron guarantee that there will be no legislation, which is right.
Well, I don't think legislation will be necessary. The Crown's position is well and truly established. We are of the view that that's the correct position to adopt, that no one owns water. At the end of the day, I can't rule out someone taking the government to court. Well, I can say if they do that, in terms of the capacity to sell shares, that would be quite a quick process, I think, in terms of the advice we've received. But in terms of someone trying to establish a water right that the government didn't want to recognise, as Canada has found, that could be a very long process.
So you would legislate in that process?
Well, you're asking me to give a view on a ruling of a court that could be 20 years from now. But all I'm telling you at the moment is I don't think that's going to be necessary to legislate, because I don't think that they are going to be in a position anytime soon to come up with something that the government finds unacceptable.
In the discussions around the framework on water, does that include things like development rights, rights of veto, commercial opportunities as well? What is
a framework? Well, if you go and have a look at the Waikato River, there's a co-governance agreement, and back in 2009, the Crown established parameters around what that co-governance looks like. Part of that co-governance is the future development and impact that that development would have on the waterway. So it's a shared decision-making authority, although the granting of resource consents still sits with the council.
And that's part of what some theory want shifted, though, isn't it? They want that power.
Well, I can't comment on that last point because that hasn't been raised, to the best of my knowledge, directly with me, but yes, they could be claiming all sorts of things in that regard.
Will you still be talking to the Freshwater EU Leaders Group, led by
Secretary Truman? Well, they had their, as you're obviously aware, on Friday, and I'm sure they'll continue to talk to the government. The Minister responsible, Amy Adams, in this case, is continuing to have discussions with them because it's part of the Land and Water Forum and the work that they've been doing there. But you know, the government's view is that there isn't the need for a national settlement.
No, but what they're trying to come up with is a national framework through which individual settlements could be reached.
I think our perspective on that would be the national framework's been established, in so much that if you go back to the work we did in 2009 around co-governance, that the purpose of doing that work back then was to be consistent with the way that we dealt with other applications for co-governance. We obviously started with the rewrite of the work the previous Labor government had done on the Waikato River, but wanted to make sure we'd be consistent with the way that we treated people going forward. There's been a number of other things we've done which would loosely form what I would say would be the approach that the government's taken, and therefore a national framework, in a similar way to the way we deal with treaty settlements. There's quite a well-trodden path
now. So that Waikato and Tainui one was the prototype.
Correct.
Against which all the others were?
Yes, because we eventually rewrote what was previously there because we didn't agree with the pathway that was going.
So Timu outlined the framework that the leaders are putting to the government on Friday, and that included things like that they provided the development rights, etc. You're saying that's not really part of what you're going to do.
Well, that's not sitting there in terms of the framework. I mean, that really fits not into the framework category, which is, I think, a question about process and the way you deal with these issues, vis-a-vis a right or interest. And as I've said to you, the government will recognise rights and interests where they think they're warranted, but if we don't think they're warranted, then we won't. That's all we're
matter. But to the extent of co-governance and guardianship.
Again, the framework that we set up in terms of the Waikato River, we think was the right one. There'll always again be leaders that will argue that there should be more, and there are different circumstances by waterways. I mean, we think there are some waterways where there are aquifers, for instance, where there's a different approach that might be taken, but generally speaking, that's the way we're addressing it.
Just looking at the John Banks controversy, yeah. Have you had a chance to read that police report?
No.
Why not?
Will you be reading it?
No, I won't be reading it.
Why not?
There's nothing's changed. I mean, in my view, A, it's politically motivated attack. Labor Party didn't care about this issue when John Banks stood for the mayoralty. Labor Party doesn't care about every other candidate that stood and was unsuccessful or successful in the same election. Labor Party didn't care about the law when they had the opportunity to fix it up. So they got a politically motivated attack. I've, through my office, asked the minister whether he's complied with the law. The advice he's given to me is he has, and I accept him at his word.
Is he an honest man, Prime Minister?
Oh, some months ago when the issue first arose.
Do you trust John Banks?
I do, yes.
In 2008, you criticised him in Clark Bush probably for standing by Winston.
Yep.
What is different with you standing by Banks now, taking him at his word?
Well, because I accept him at his word, and if I've proven otherwise, well, that's a different issue. But there's a broad interpretation of that law, and there's no charges being laid against John Banks. He's not going to be found guilty of any crime. That's a different situation to when, after a long period of time, you'll remember if you go back to the Owen Glenn Winston Peters situation, for 6 months we actually didn't make any substantial comments. It was when the email presented itself that we said Prime Minister of the Day had to act on.
With regard to the assurance Mr. Banks made.
Sorry, Jason,
hasn't his word been discredited though because of that OIA report?
No. The way I would interpret what I've seen in terms of the media is that there are differences of opinions, and also, and that's always going to be the case, the way people characterise discussions. And secondly, the question is whether he complied with the law. This government happens to think that law is pretty poor, quite broad, and needs reworking.
How do you know, though, if you haven't read the report?
Well, in terms of the media reports I've seen.
With regard, though, to the assurances that Mr. Banks made to your chief of staff, was the assurance that he hadn't broken the law, or was the assurance that he couldn't remember accepting donations? Because in the House last week, Labor asserted the latter.
Well, the assurance is that he believes he's complied with the law.
So he never made an assurance to you that he didn't remember receiving donations?
He's made any assurances to me. He's made them to my chief of staff, and that's that he complied with the law.
So he never made an assurance to your chief of staff that he didn't recollect receiving any donations?
Oh, I can't answer that last point because it was part of the conversation.
Why don't you ask him yourself if he's lying?
Well, I don't need to because my office is in constant contact with his office on a variety of different issues. If he'd had a change of heart, there would have been plenty of opportunity for him to communicate that. He hasn't, which means he feels very comfortable with what he's told me.
Have you asked staff in your office to look through all of that material to see whether there is any matters of concern?
No, because it's not for me to do a forensic analysis of that. My job is to have confidence in a minister or to lose confidence in a minister. To lose confidence, I have to think that they mislead me.
You're not going to know
that
if you don't look through the material.
No, there's no case to be held against Mr. Banks. He's not broken the law.
It doesn't make you uncomfortable that in February he was telling a lawyer about the electoral support that he received from Kim.com, and then in April he was telling the media that he couldn't remember any electoral support.
No, all as I said to you earlier, there's always a wide, wide variation in the interpretation of the conversation. The Electoral Act, my understanding of it, is it's quite broad in its current situation. It's quite possible and legitimate for someone to speak to a donor about wanting them to donate. It's quite legitimate under the current law to say that if they wanted to do so, they could be done anonymously. All those things are quite legitimate within the current law.
The point I just made to the lawyer when he was a minister in your government and the statements he made to the media which contradicted those.
No, there are the interpretation of one person. This is none.
I think he said that he couldn't help Kim.com in prison because it could get embarrassing.
No, that's the interpretation of the lawyer's view of the discussion.
It's not just the lawyer, it's several people put in.
Well, there's people have their own interpretations on these matters. I'm not a party to all of that. All I can tell you is the test is, has he misled me? And we've got no reason to believe that.
Do you think someone out of these, someone is lying out of that?
No, there's always people that have a different interpretation on a conversation. But my point is that the law is very broad. So it's quite possible for someone under the existing law to comply with the law and have extensive conversations about donations.
Even if there is doubt about whether he's misled you, and you know, you could argue that this police report raises such doubt, isn't it incumbent on you as Prime Minister, in terms of the public's view of ministers and their standards, to actually look into it further if there is information available to you?
No, because you'd be making the case that I should do a forensic analysis about every minister who gives me information. I'm not in the process to do that. I'm afraid I'm terribly sorry, but I won't be doing that. If I rely on a minister to say whether they can, you know, meet their requirements or not. In this case, he believes he complied with the law.
Would you not seek another assurance from him, given the release of the police report and the sworn statements that do appear to contradict Mr. Banks's earlier statements?
We see plenty of opportunity to change his position if he wanted to, and on that basis we'll accept that he's of the view that he has been. As I said earlier, nothing's changed.
Do you think Mr. Banks has misled the public with the statement?
I haven't looked at all of his comments. You'd have to put that to Mr. Banks.
But would that not be a serious matter to you if the public were fairly misled?
Well, I haven't looked at all of his statements. You'd need to put that to him. But as I said to you, the law is very broad, and the way someone might interpret something vis-a-vis what is actually the legally correct position can be quite different.
Have you been advised not to look into the matter, because by not looking into the matter, you cannot be misled?
No, I haven't received any advice on the matter.
Labour says this is just a numbers game and you need John Mix's support. What do you say to that?
I say Labour are running a politically motivated campaign, fair enough, but they're not looking at anybody else, are they?
No one else is a government minister now.
They seem to care a lot about the issue today. They don't care much about it when they're in government.
So is John Banks an honest man?
In my opinion, yes.
Are you getting sick of defending him? Would it be great for Peter Welch to resign?
No and no.
Have you had any advice on Spring Creek and whether the government might offer some either assistance there or perhaps some instruction to Solid Energy to treat that as a special commercial case?
The new chairman is looking closely at the matter. I think it's fair to say that there have been some real concerns about the viability of Spring Creek. It hasn't been in operation for the better part of nearly 12 months, I think certainly quite a long period of time. We said to the incoming chairman we wanted him to look very closely at the matter because obviously it involves the livelihood of a couple of hundred plus workers on the West Coast, and whatever decision was or has to be made about the mine, we needed to be absolutely confident that the right decision was being made. He's gone away and committed to do that, and he's likely to report back to us within about a week.
Back to John Banks, and you have championed transparency in the government. Why should Banks be held to be any different if he won't release a statement from the statement he gave to
police? That's simply a matter for him. I mean, this is a historical matter. When he wasn't a minister of the Crown, people have all sorts of reasons about whether they release something or not. That's a matter for him.
Isn't he, though, effectively, aren't you his Prime Minister in this scenario, and do you need to step in an instruction to do that? Because he's not the actual leader.
Yes and no. That's the question.
Which is the yes bit?
Yes, I'm his Prime Minister. No, it's not my job to instruct him. But look, the test is whether I believe he's misled me. And at this point, I've got no evidence to prove that he hasn't.
But don't you need to read the report to be able to do that?
No, as I said earlier, I don't go through a forensic analysis. You know, this is a system based on trust. The minister tells me he complied with the law, and he believes he has, as I think I've read something in the paper that the police may well believe a similar thing in terms of him not looking at the document when he signed it. It's good enough.
You told Parliament in early May that your chief of staff had received an assurance that he did not know where that donation had come from.
Correct.
Why that comment, is that what he told
Wayne Anderson? Yes, in terms of the first question, in terms of the letter, I can't tell you exactly what he told him because it wasn't part of that conversation, but that was the advice I received at the time. And that goes back to the point I made earlier. I mean, you know, the law is extremely broad. We might not all like it, which is why this government's changing it. And the Labor Party doesn't like it, and they should have changed it when they had the chance to do it with central government. But you can, under the local government law, solicit a donation. You can tell people how to do that anonymously. But if lots of donations for $25,000 turn up in an account, you can't guarantee that they've come from that particular donor. So lots of people will tell you that they will donate. It doesn't mean they actually do.
So it's your understanding that his assurance went past complying with the law, but also that he did not know where that donation had come from, or that he'd received one from .com?
Well, it's my understanding of the words I used in Parliament.
Don't you think the public are getting a bit sick of politicians, and it goes back to the previous government too, complaining that the rules or the law are broad and confusing, and politicians don't seem to know how to act properly?
Well, it's incumbent on every New Zealander to comply with the law. So all laws are terribly confusing. There are lots of examples where we have situations where people apply to the courts because they don't believe the law has been properly interpreted. I mean, we might all sit around and not like the law, but if a person's complied with the law, then it's not a hanging against.
Doesn't the cabinet manual actually talk about ethical standards as
yep,
well?
And that's behaviour held when they have a warrant.
If the rules are as confusing as Mr Banks has alleged, how could he have been so confident that he hadn't broken any rules and make that assurance to you?
You have to ask Mr Banks.
I'm
going to
finish. Yeah. The government announced those changes to the Liberal electoral law on the same day as files were released. Was there any coincidence in that time?
We've been thinking about doing that for some time. So, you know, look, I don't know exactly whether they've completely married up in that day, but...
Did any of the government talk to police around the time of the...
I certainly can't answer that question.
Did your discussions in Vladivostok leave you feeling more or less optimistic about the economic outlook for the region near term?
The way I frame it is that it's sort of 4 years on now from the global financial crisis. And I think leaders are becoming more accustomed to living and working and operating in an environment which is just challenging and likely to be so for quite some period of time. I don't think anyone's expecting the situation in Europe to be resolved quickly. We always live in hope that the US economy will start doing better, but again, you know, it's been a long, slow process, and there are obviously some the odd signs of concern around Asia. So there's a healthy dose of realism there. But I think a genuine belief that we can work our way through it, and most governments are taking a similar approach to what you're seeing in New Zealand, which is let's go out there and try and affect the things that are directly within our control, have a plan to try and resolve those issues as we do, and make the best of it. I actually think we're doing quite well in New Zealand, relatively speaking. But if you think about things like national savings rates, we had a decade, and well, actually longer, from 2000 to 2008. Where people spent more than they earned. That situation is going to be reversed, and if you want to accept the Treasury advice, it will be reversed for a very long period of time.
In a research note today, Bernard Doyle at JB Weir has said that the Reserve Bank should be regarding the New Zealand economy as being in serious danger of becoming financially unstable, partly as a result of our strong dollar and partly because of the slowdown in global growth. He said they're effectively importing other people's problems because of our own relative strength. What's your view on that?
Well, I mean, at one level, you'd have to say the strength of the New Zealand dollar is reflected in the international confidence in the New Zealand economy and the direction that we're taking the economy. So I'm not sure you can really make the case that that is so. Secondly, yes, there are obviously impacts directly on exporters who export their goods solely in US dollars and who aren't commodity linked, but 60% of all global trade is in intermediate goods. And so you import a part to export something. Thirdly, you know, if it wasn't for the high exchange rate, New Zealanders would be paying more at the pump. They'd arguably be paying more, well, certainly be paying more for imported goods, and they'd be arguably paying more for essentially, or likely have higher levels of inflation. So if you look at all of those things, I mean, I think to say that New Zealand economy is unstable is nonsense. We have a floating exchange rate. In the event that people were concerned, the exchange rate would be one of the first signs to demonstrate that. And I actually think New Zealand economy is in pretty strong shape. We grew at 1.1% for the first quarter. We're on track for a positive second quarter. Yes, yeah, difficult international environment, but you'll be okay.
I promise you'll be voting against the St. Peter's Reserve Bank
We will be.
Bill, on Wednesday. But is it time to take a look at the Reserve Bank and see whether the priority and price stability is really best practice in the post-GFC environment?
We have, because that's required as a part of the appointment of the new Reserve Bank Governor. We've got a briefing at Cabinet today about the possible changes that might be made as a result of the new policy targets agreement that will be signed between the incoming Governor Graham Wheeler and the Minister of Finance. I'll leave that for the Minister of Finance to talk more about that, but what I can say is that any changes are very modest. So we have effectively done a review and we're comfortable we're on the right track.
But you're unlikely to change that emphasis on price
stability? No, I mean the general advice and the general agreement between the incoming Governor and the Minister of Finance is that the settings are about right.
Are you likely to include any more emphases other than just price stability?
There's some very minor changes, but hasten to add they're minor, and you need to take those up with the Ministry of Finance when he announces.
But emphasising other areas than just price stability?
I wouldn't read too much into it, it's pretty minor.
It's an expectation that back prudential levers might be used earlier rather than later.
Well, I think generally speaking, that's been a view that Alan Bollard had as well, that in terms of stability of the financial markets, greater control over financial institutions and the capacity to look at their lending ratios, for instance, was critically important. That's why the previous governor actually changed and instituted various rules and a different level of compliance. So I think that's already there, to be honest.
When will the government make an announcement on the Vinnie report and the bank compensation plan?
I understand the minister's getting a bit more advice on that.
Yeah, when do you expect that?
I don't know. Didn't come to Cabinet today.
Didn't
come to Cabinet today, no.
How long, though, do you think the process will take for a final announcement to be made?
Don't know. Obviously, look, it would be an important decision one way or the other, and so we need to just be absolutely sure we're right before we make that decision, so I won't have a time frame on it.
I'm following the two
deaths
and the questions raised about the resources out there. Is that something that
you've
been looking at?
No, I can't specifically comment about that. I mean, generally speaking, we've been very happy with the way the crime rates have been tracking lower. As you sort of saw from the Herald on Sunday, they did quite an extensive report on it. I think there's been a lot to be gained from the new approach that the police have been taking with policing and excellence and the neighbourhood policing teams. What particularly happened in that event, the police are in a better place to comment.
Is it still your view that sending SAS troops back to Afghanistan in a combat role wouldn't make sense?
Correct.
In Japan, did Prime Minister Noda mention anything about the tripartite pact with China and South Korea and signal his intentions about that pact?
No. I mean, we talked briefly about the territorial rights issues, but in terms of disputed land issues between that. Thank you.